Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea on the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. A reminder to sign up for our weekly Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with the links to the articles and books that I have discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our sponsors and friends, Janet and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Sefer Bereishis finally comes to its conclusion. In the final chapter of the story, Yaakov gathers all of his children and tells them that he intends to reveal the end of the story, capital E. When is Mashiach going to come? This was not just the end of their story, but the end of the collective story of the Jewish people. Yaakov was going to reveal, as Rashi explains, when Mashiach will come. And then suddenly he stops. Instead, he gives each child a blessing. I just have to give a shout out right now to my third grade Rebbe, Rabbi Florence. Third grade, we're actually taught Birchas Yaakov. That's the part of the Torah that we're reading and talking about right now. And it's hard to even discuss this without having that tune with the translation come to your head. I'll give you a line just because you're begging me. Vayikra Yaakov el banav, and Yaakov called to his sons. Still with me, still remember nearly all of it. Thank you, Rabbi Florence. So Yaakov gives each child a blessing. This closing chapter is bizarre. This is the end of Sefer Bereishis. Firstly, why did Yaakov want to reveal the end of the story? What was he intending to accomplish? And why all of a sudden did he stop? Lastly, why did Yaakov instead give each child a blessing? Rashi explains that Yaakov lost his vision of the end of days, of when the Mashiach was going to come, and instead just decided to talk about other things. Really? Was this like a tense Shabbos meal where someone brings up a sensitive subject until mom pipes in and says, why don't we talk about something more pleasant? What exactly was Yaakov Avinu doing? Yaakov's original plan to reveal the end of days seems strange, and his plan B seems even stranger. Okay, I can't tell you about the Messianic age, but enjoy your consolation prize, a blessing. Everyone gets a blessing. How should we understand this sequence of events? To understand all of this, let's explore one of the most exciting chapters in Jewish history, the attempt to find the lost tribes. A big shout out first to my friend Nachi Weinstein, host of the Sfarim Chatter podcast. He's actually rolling out an incredible series on the lost tribes now. His guidance on this subject, as well as his book recommendations, were invaluable for this exploration. If you haven't already, be sure to check out his podcast, particularly his incredible series on the lost tribes, happening right now. I already listened to the first episode. It was fantastic. His treatment of Jewish history is always eye-opening. Thank you, Nachi, for your friendship and for your help. The last we really hear about the 10 tribes is in the 17th chapter in the second book of Malachim, Malachim Beis. Following the split of the Jewish kingdom, the Assyrian Empire attacks the Jewish people and exiles the Israelite kingdom, leaving the kingdom of Yehuda, Malchus Yehuda, intact. There is much speculation about which precise tribes were the ones actually exiled, and even how many were exiled. It's not all that clear in Tanakh, but by the time of the Mishnah, it is taken out as a given that 10 tribes were lost. While the Mishnah records a dispute about whether we should ever even expect the lost tribes to return, that very possibility has been wrapped up with messianic expectations. As Tzvi Ben-Dor Benait, I believe I'm pronouncing that name correctly, in his incredible book, this is a jaw-dropping book, it is the book to read on the subject, it is called The 10 Lost Tribes, A World History. It is the most comprehensive treatment on the subject, writes as follows. As we have seen, the 10 tribes belong in the messianic package. All the prophets lump their return together with the other signs of the end of time. If the central question about the 10 lost tribes has long been, where are they? Then the central question concerning the messianic age is, when will it happen? An untold number of thinkers have undertaken to answer that question. The search for the lost tribes, infused with messianic expectations, have brought Indiana Jones-like characters, I kid you not, out of the woodwork, both from within and outside the Jewish community. The Maharal, in a remarkable passage in his work Netzach Yisrael, I believe in the 34th chapter of Netzach Yisrael, warns people not to despair from the increasingly detailed cartography, that's a fancy word, for drawing maps that emerged in his generation. Even if we map out much of the world, the Maharal said, there are still places that are unknown to civilization where the lost tribes may still reside, so don't give up. One of the earliest and most fabulous tales about the lost tribes is the story of Eldad Hadani. It's one of the first. In 1883, in 883. So used to saying 18. No, in 883, just shy of 1,000 years after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, a mysterious traveler named Eldad Hadani arrived at the Jewish community in North Africa, claiming to be from the lost tribe of Dun, hence the name Eldad Hadani. He shared harrowing stories, escaping cannibals, being sold into slavery. Wild stuff, but most importantly claimed that the lost tribes remain intact. Beyond the Sambation River, which is a whole nother discussion where we're told the lost tribes resides. The lost tribes, Eldad Hadani said, still rule themselves with a powerful army and a glorious civilization. The only way, Eldad explains, that the lost tribes communicate with one another, with the rest of the world beyond this river, is with carrier pigeons. It's hard to ignore, and you'll kill me for saying it, but I gotta say it, because I'm a comic book fan. It's hard to ignore the resemblance to Wakanda, the fictional city in Marvel's Black Panther. Eldad's tale circulated and more recently have been translated into English with a commentary by Micha J. Perry in his book Eldad's Travels, A Journey from the Lost Tribes to the Present. Really fascinating work where he takes you through all these tales with commentary. The question as to the veracity of Eldad's claims was actually sent before Rav Tzemach Gaon, who responded positively to Eldad's claims. This became the first in a line of major rabbinic questions evaluating the halachic possibility that those claiming to be from the lost tribes, even those isolated for centuries, should still retain their Jewish identity. The most notable and exhaustive rabbinic treatment of this question is from David Ben Zimra, known as the Radvaz or the Radbaz, depending on how you like to pronounce things, who wrote a long teshuva, long responsa, which you can find in the fourth volume of his responsa. I have it, of course, linked in our Substack. It's in Chelek Dalet. And again, there are different ways that he numbers it, but this number that I have it linked to is 1290. And he talks about the halachic status of a child born to a woman claiming descent from the lost tribes. This responsa was central to the modern day halachic debate of accepting Ethiopian Jews into the state of Israel through the law of return. Many of these responsa rely on the reports of Eldad Hadani as factual. The lost tribes still exist and can, in fact, return. Perhaps one of the most remarkable stories involving the search for the lost tribes was led by Menashe ben Yisroel, one of the most incredible figures in Jewish history. His life should and could totally be a movie. It is riveting. If you want to learn more about his life and something that really helped me putting this together, I would check out the Yale Jewish Live series. They have a biography on Menashe ben Yisroel, Rabbi of Amsterdam, written by Stephen Nadler. Menashe ben Yisroel lived for a period actually in the same neighborhood as the famous artist Rembrandt. There's a second book on that, which also Stephen Nadler wrote, called Rembrandt's Jews. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, really a page turner. I'm sure we'll talk more about that book. So Menashe ben Yisroel lived for a period in the same neighborhood as Rembrandt and may have even advised Rembrandt on some of his artistic depictions of the Bible. I'm sure we will come back to that probably pretty soon. Some even assume one of Rembrandt's small rabbinic etchings is of Menashe ben Yisroel, though there are some who debate whether it is in fact him. In 1644, Antonio Montezinos, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, who also went by the Jewish name Aaron Levy, arrived in Amsterdam with a report that he had found the lost tribes. During his time wandering as a Portugal converso, he stumbled upon an Indian tribe in South America. He was convinced they were from the lost tribes. They recited Shema and claimed their forefathers were, of course, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. After arriving in Amsterdam, his story soon became a cause célèbre. People were very excited about this, and it was finally taken to Menashe ben Yisroel, who was one of the most prominent rabbis in the world at the time, who also was living in Amsterdam. This was not an exclusively Jewish fascination. There were a lot of non-Jews involved in this, and we could just give a quick shout out to the stories of Prester John. You can follow Nachi Weinstein. I'm sure he's going to do an episode on this, and you can check that out. But for Menashe ben Yisroel, the person who was really important was John Dury, who was a Calvinist minister, who also heard about Montezino's stories about these Indians who claimed descent from the lost tribes. He became convinced that the American Indians were from these lost tribes, an idea that fueled his Christian hopes that the reemergence of the lost tribes might usher in the end of days. More and more Christian millenarians, people who were like convinced the end of days were near, began reaching out to Menashe ben Yisroel in the hopes that he could either confirm the existence of the lost tribes or, at the very least, investigate these reports. Initially, Menashe, while intrigued, was not convinced. But Rabbi Menashe ben Yisroel returned to the prophecies of Daniel and began to wonder if, in fact, his Christian friends were perhaps onto something. In the 12th 12th parak of Daniel, the 12th chapter, it's written, when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, the Jewish people, all these things shall be finished. When the Jewish people occupy all corners of the world, then finally they will be gathered together and bring the redemption. Perhaps, Menashe ben Yisrael reasoned, the way to bring the Messianic age is to have Jews scattered in each corner of the world. And with this discovery of alleged Jews in the Americas, perhaps they were the American Indians, maybe the time of Mashiach has finally arrived. There was, however, one problem. Even if the Indians were in fact the lost tribes, there was still one place that did not have Jews. And this was Menashe ben Yisrael's reasoning. That place, England. Jews were expelled from England in 1290 under the orders of Edward I. It seemed like redemption was so close. Jews were scattered everywhere. Maybe they're the American Indians. They're in the Americas. If only they would be allowed readmission to England, then Jews would truly cover the globe and they would be then be gathered together and usher in the end of days. Rav Menashe ben Yisrael published his work Mikveh Yisroel in 1650, all about the possibility of regathering all of the Jews spread throughout the world, including these alleged American Indians who could be from the Lost Tribes. It was an outgrowth of his correspondence with Christian millenarians and was published in three languages, Spanish, Latin, and English, in the hopes that its content would persuade the widest audience possible of the messianic potential of locating all of the Lost Tribes and having Jews throughout the world. Mikveh Yisrael opens with a dedication addressed specifically to English Parliament. That's why he's publishing it. He wants to get on their radar, but a book alone would not be enough to persuade a country to readmit Jews centuries after they were expelled. We're now in the 1600s. Jews were expelled at the very end of the 1200s in 1290. Instead, Menashe decided to travel to England in the hopes of prevailing upon Parliament, and he departed to England in September of 1655. The English people were not as enthusiastic about the readmission of the Jewish people. In the translator's preface to the English edition of Mikveh Yisrael, the translator, whose name was Moses Wall, writes that his goal, why'd he translate this into English, was to remove our sinful hatred from off that people. Like, it is unbecoming for us Englishmen to still hate Jews with such a passion. That is why he translated it. But clearly, it was an issue. Otherwise, he wouldn't have made a point of making sure that it was translated into English. Oliver Cromwell, then Lord Protector of England, was not dismissive of Menashe ben Yisrael. Menashe was careful when he made the case for the return of the Jewish people to couch it primarily in utilitarian reasons, specifically the potential boon Jews could offer the economy. We'll bring in trade. We'll bring in goods. We're going to get the economy restarted. And if you know about English history, this was a very precarious time. This is right after the collapse of the monarchy of Charles I. Cromwell was in favor of the Jewish return to England, but when the vote was brought before the government body for debate in what was known as the Whitehall Conference, they emerged without a clear recommendation. Menashe ben Yisrael was crestfallen. It seemed his mission to England failed. His disappointment turned to mourning when his son, Shmuel Samuel, who accompanied him to London, died in September of 1657. He had been in England for over 2 years. He left England a broken man, and Menashe ben Yisrael died just a month later after returning from England on November 20th, 1657. Menashe's efforts, however, were not a complete failure. Charles II, who many years earlier in 1651 lost a battle to Oliver Cromwell and went into exile, finally returned and assumed the throne in 1660. Cromwell had passed away 2 years earlier in 1658, but Charles II, after assuming the throne in 1660, ordered that the remains of Oliver Cromwell be exhumed, and his head was mounted on a spike outside of Westminster Hall, where it remained, the head of Oliver Cromwell, for the next 25 years. But the small Jewish community that surfaced during the time when Menashe ben Yisrael was trying to gain favor in the parliament, they stuck around and they remained, and Charles II officially allowed them to stay. And in a really fascinating twist in all of this, who led that London community? They brought one of Menashe ben Yisrael's former colleagues from Amsterdam, none other than Rev Yaakov Sesportis, to lead the community. And Rev Sesportis, just a few years later, later would lead the battle against none other than Shabtai Tzvi. He was the number one adversary for the messianism of Shabtai Tzvi. Menashe ben Yisrael's efforts to bring redemption would ultimately provide a platform for Rav Yaakov Sesportis to assure the false messianic hopes of Shabtai Tzvi would never be realized. Let's return back to our Parsha, where Yaakov gathers his children, the 12 tribes. He wants to reveal the end of days to them. What was he hoping to accomplish? Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap suggests something absolutely incredible. He writes as follows: Omek Cheftzo Ubikashto Shel Yaakov Avinu Alav Shalom Lagalos Hasachetz Lo Hayi Lagalos Masayi Aketz. The reason, the passion, the intensity why Yaakov wanted to reveal the end wasn't just to give them a date. Demai Nafka Mina Bezeh. What difference does it make what day this is going to happen, the end of days? Aval Kavanaso Lagalos Es Hagula Shebetoch Hagalos. He wanted to reveal to them the redemptive, the ability to feel redemptiveness even within the exile. Hayos v'hagolos hi shorish ha-ge'ula, since exile is the foundation for redemption. Hari ha-ge'ula chavuya betoch ha-golos. There is redemption hidden and buried within the exile. So that is why he wanted to tell them this to them. Yaakov was not trying to reveal a date. What day will Mashiach come? Rather, he wanted to give his children the ability to discover redemption even amid exile. Yaakov wanted his children to remain connected to redemption even while they were displaced in exile. But exile and redemption are intertwined. If they knew too much about redemption, exile would lose its redemptive power. So God prevented him from revealing the end. And in fact, this is something very similar to what the Sfas Emes says. The Sfas Emes says something also incredible. The Sfas Emes says something remarkable, quoting his Rebbe, Reb Simcha Banami Pshischa, who asked, why did Yaakov want to reveal the end? And he answers, V'tiritz shekishenoda haketz hagolos benoka. When you know the end, the exile is very easy. Ad kan anizocha, the Sfas Emes writes, that's all I remember. My dear friend Josh Rosenfeld shared this Sfas Emes many years ago on Twitter. My other friend Ben Greenfeld responded, it's brilliant that he doesn't know the end of this teaching. It's this poetic parallelism where Yaakov Avinu wants to reveal the end but gets stopped in the middle and can't say the full date and the full moment when the end of days is going to happen. And the Sfas Emes, in repeating over this Torah, also kind of halts in the middle and says, that's all I remember. But it's a remarkable teaching that Yaakov wanted to reveal the end to make the middle, that experience in exile, easier. He wanted to help his children see redemption even in exile. After Yaakov loses the ability to transmit his redemptive vision, he does something else. The closest thing to actual redemption, he gives his children blessings. This, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky explains, provides a glimpse of redemption. Why is that? Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says something absolutely beautiful. He writes, Kol echad mehashvat He wanted everyone to be there to hear one another's blessings. He didn't just want to give a blessing to each child in a private moment alone with one child one-on-one. He blesses each child in front of the rest in order to ensure that each child hears one another's blessings. Yaakov wanted to impress on each of the tribes, on each of his children, that every individual has their own strengths and blessings, and that each of your blessings differs from one another. More important than the blessing each child received was the knowledge that each child learned that every other child in the family has a different blessing and strength of their own. And that is a redemptive capacity, seeing the unique purpose and strength of all of those around you. Each tribe, their own ability. Each tribe, finally found. So thank you so much for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all of the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our sponsors, Jana and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.